Hello everyone, good afternoon. My name is Nir Ben-Tzvi, and with me is Stan Sims from the Information Security in MSIT. He joined me to tell you a little bit about what we're doing in MSIT with the technologies that we're going to show you today. Thank you very much for coming, thank you for your time. We'll be going through dynamic access control. This is the third year that we've been doing this talk. There's a lot of very technical talks that you can find on the web, videos that we talk about technical details. I'm going to stay at the 200 level, but if you guys want, I'll be happy to answer any question. We're going to give you the intro because it's an intro session to give you context about how you can use dynamic access control, what does it mean. It has a wide range of technologies involved. And we'll also talk about a little bit about some toolkits that we publish in order to make the deployment of dynamic access control easier. And last, we'll see some examples of people that already tried it out, deployed it, and what were the conclusions. It's really about helping you understand why we build dynamic access control. If you look at what Microsoft is doing in the security area, and I've been working in this area for the last 5 years, you know, it's really a continuous investment of trying to help customers fight the current threats as the threats evolve. So these kind of technologies that we released in 2012 are very, very relevant today. And we will continue to improve these as well as bring other technologies into the fold so we can help you stay secure. Now, how many of you deployed already Server 2012? Okay, that's cool. And just for me, because I'm a file server guy, how many of you use file servers? Okay. Who's not using file servers? Okay, come talk to me afterwards. I'll give you a lot of reason to use it. But, you know, I think that when we look at the overall lay of the land, and we've been looking at it for the last 10 years since SharePoint came out. You know, at some point, we thought SharePoint is going to just take over. We're done. We should just, you know, phase off file servers, SharePoint, you know, invest in SharePoint, that's it. And SharePoint did take over, and it's huge. SharePoint is huge. It's I think the amount of data changing in SharePoint every year on-prem is around 800 petabytes a year, just growth. So it's very big. However, file servers are still there, and guess what? They're also growing at 800 petabytes per year, just the information worker workloads, like what we call users folders, you know, your traditional departmental share, your publication shares, all kind of stuff, application shares. So you have tons of data being created on file servers and on SharePoint, and you need to be able to protect them. And I'll explain why. You know, this is a slide I've been showing for 5 years. It's very consistent, and it's not changing. There's only one change that I'll show you in a second that we realized that we were not that clever, and we weren't aware of it, but now we are. And so, you know, a lot of users, huge amounts of data, and there's regulatory compliance. You know, you need to make sure your HIPAA data is appropriately protected, your PII, your PCI, and so on. This is all going to stay with us for a long, long time. It's not going to change. And we should make sure that we adhere to it because, you know, our companies rely on these regulations to make sure that they don't go the other way. Now, there's another thing that's going on that we just found, or we didn't just find it, but it became really public in the last 2 or 3 years. Actually, just yesterday, there was an article about the NSA putting some stuff into Cisco routers as part of the assembly line as they get shipped out so that they can make sure that they get the data. So I just want to highlight that a little bit because this is a really, really important part of the story. Now, when you think about it, just last year, you know, there were 63,000 confirmed security incidents in 2013. And I just want to point out that these were the dumb guys that got caught. Okay, so if you look to the right, and if you look to the left, and if you look at yourself, the chances are 99% that your organization has been breached. And this is a really, really serious problem. People are getting into organizations through users' passwords, through security vulnerabilities, and so on. And what do these people want to do? You know, there's one confirmed, there was one incident that people went into a Saudi Arabia oil company and basically torched all their machines. So that's a denial of service attack. That's actually pretty cool. It was a big kind of protest. So some people do that. Some people do breaches for that. But 99% of the people that do breaches and are very, very good, they have a lot of money, are there to steal your information, to take you out of business, to make you look bad. And if you look in your organization, you have nothing to prevent this. You know, I bet you if you go back, if you think about how vulnerable we are, in Microsoft as well, to this kind of attacks of some users being able to get some access to the network, and then from there on leap around from one machine to another, steal information, do whatever they want. Now, a lot of companies, or some companies that we know of, went out of business because of that. So this is a really, really big threat. And it's all about access to your information. And it's all about also being able to detect that, because as I said, 63,000 cases are the dumb hackers that you are able to catch. There's many others that you just don't see. They come into the network, steal the stuff, go out. And we hear only about the cases like the Target guys that got, just resigned and so on. I think when we talk about in Microsoft, we have the New York, we're saying that the New York Journal is our best spec to justify the security work that we need to do, because they keep publishing, this guy got breached and that guy got breached and so on. So we're going to talk a little bit about today about how the technologies we released in 2012 can help you to overcome these kind of things. And we really can, and it's not such a big effort to really take your security level from here to here. And people have done it. So with that, there's a few personas that we look at in an organization, from your CXO, CIO, CSO, they want to make sure that the organization is secure. Microsoft, actually it was the legal guy, the LCA guy, said, we're going to encrypt everything. That's their kind of, we want to make sure people don't get to our information. We want to make sure our customers are secure. And who do they go to? To the infrastructure guys. So they go to Stan and say, Stan, make sure we're secure. Now, the problem is they don't give them the tool or the money to go execute on it. So there's a lot of work for the IT guys to do. And I just want you to know that we think in Windows Server, it's very important to help you guys do that. How many of you guys, by the way, as I'm going to talk about other things, but how many of you guys heard about what Jeffrey Snover talked about with Just Enough Administration? Okay, so if you're in the room and you care about security, securing your servers, you need to listen to that talk, because it tells you how you can take your current servers, no need to change them, no need to upgrade to any new server and so on, current server from 2008 or 2 and above, and get their security to be 10 times more than what you have today. Or I would say infinite more, but I wouldn't go there. So the session was on Wednesday, and it's Jeffrey Snover. Take a look at that session. It's a great session that shows you how we're thinking about securing your servers from administrators, because believe it or not, we are the attack vectors. It's not the, you know, somebody coming and trying to go through the firewall and so on. We, the administrators, folks that have administrative access to the servers, are the attack vectors. By the way, just to get some more information from you guys. So how many of you guys are domain administrators? Okay. All. And how many of you guys have more than 10 domain administrators in your company? Okay, how many of you guys have more than 10 folks that deal with the servers to patch them and so on? Okay, so if you're thinking about that vendor that goes and you know, patches your servers, that gets paid $20 an hour, somebody can easily come to him with $1 million offer and get full control over your all systems. These are the kind of things that, this is the kind of thinking that we have evolved to think about how can we help you, how can we help you protect against that. And, you know, Jeffrey's talk about just enough administration is really targeting that. Okay, and so we said the IT guys, it's hard to configure the servers, they don't know what the information is. How can they make sure everything is appropriately encrypted, unless they encrypt everything, which then creates a havoc with people trying to use the files. So that doesn't work as well. The content owners actually know what the files are. They know what files are important, what files are less important, but they don't have any tools to do anything about it. And last, the information workers simply do not care unless they are ordered it's actually part of their work to do something. They're not going to protect your information. So from an information protection perspective, I told you to take a look at what Jeffrey has done to protect the server access. Now let's talk about how we protect the information. So somebody's inside your organization, they're going to get after your data. What can you do? Okay. So first of all, you need to know where the important information is so that you can protect it. And you can encrypt everything, game over, but then you have usability issues. So that doesn't work. So let's first identify the important information so we can better protect it. So we call that data classification. And by the way, if you look at it again, I've been talking about it for 5 years now. You know, Exchange, which have been our partners for a while, are doing the same thing. You know, being able to classify the data so that you get insight into your data and you can take action. Now, then we built something we call expression-based access control. So now you can actually, once you know what the data is, you can actually apply access based on that knowledge. You remember that I told you that 63,000 cases were the dumb one that got caught? We want to get more people getting caught. So if you audit the access to your important information, you can actually catch much more, suspicious activities than anything else. Because if I see that somebody tried to access 100 of my finance department files in the last second, that's probably not a human being doing something good there. And you can actually catch that. And last but not least, you want to encrypt your sensitive information so that administrators and people that should not have access to it do not have access to it. And that is the key thing to protect against breaches. If you can encrypt your information, it doesn't matter who has access to it, they're not going to be able to actually open it if they're not allowed to. Okay, so data classification is not easy. That's, you know, I talk about it all the time. It's not easy, but it's doable. It's actually surprisingly much easier than you think. As long as you don't try to design everything by committee and you have someone using common sense to just start with something, you can really quickly get at a very, very good data classification. It's not 100%. It would never be 100%. But you can get really good. You can cover a lot of your bases. Actually, Stan is going to talk about how we did that in the Microsoft servers. You can classify the data based on where it lands. So if it's in the finance department shares, you can classify it as department equals finance. You can classify it based on the content. If it has some social security number, let's say it has more than 100 social security numbers, probably something you don't want to be going around without any encryption. We introduce mechanisms that allow you to, as the file hits the server, on the file server looks at it and says, oh, you have some sensitive information, let me go tag it so that only the right access would apply to that file. So these kind of things were solutions that you would go and buy and pay, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars for, plus consulting services to go and deploy it in your organization, you yourself can do within, you know, a day or two on your file servers. And again, I have the living proof here. And he will talk about how we did it. And then we allow you, know, when you talk about file servers, in MSIT, just the folks that I work with on a daily basis have just managed only 600 file servers. Of course, we have, I think, at least 2,000-3,000. So you can't really go server by server, RDP to it, and say, oh, configure this, configure that. So we have the data classification toolkit that allows you to kind of take a baseline configuration and apply it across all the servers. So let me show you how it looks like. By the way, I forgot to mention, if you have questions, please ask them during the session. Okay, so if you have like, oh, I want to know this, I want to know that, please ask it then so that I can better help you understand, because I'm jumping between, there's many technologies I'm talking about. Okay. All right, so I'm on my file server. Another thing I want to note to you of how stable Windows Server 2012 is. This is a demo environment that I'm running on 2012. I didn't even upgrade it to R2. It is running continuously for 3 years now on my laptop. And I've never had a problem up to today, so knock on wood, it would still work. But the thing is just working. I have no complaints. So if I go to my department shares, you know, and I have here, you know, engineering, finance, HR, and operations, let's say I'm a content owner. So I own the finance department. So I created my share, and I can go to my share and right-click properties and say, choose classification. And I see a bunch of classification that I can assign to this share or to this folder or to a file if I go to a file. And let me put it up here for you. So you see, I see a bunch of classification. Where is this coming from? It's coming from Active Directory. So I have definitions in Active Directory that I can see across all my servers so that I can classify everything in a consistent way. And I can choose, you know, department. And I have here the list, again, coming from Active Directory of the department. I can say this department equals finance. I apply it. And this just got applied to all the files within this finance department. The way this works is that we use a mechanism called file classification infrastructure. And it basically allows you to set properties on files. And if you set it on a folder, it will set it on all the files in this folder. If you put another file in that folder, it's going to get inherited. And the reason, the way it gets inherited is that this is actually, we store it in the security descriptor. So it's inherited just like any other security attribute on the file from the folder. We also store it in an alternate data stream so that if the file moves to another server, since the security descriptor is not persistent, the file classification would remain on it and the other server would actually also recognize it. And then for file formats that allow it, such as Office, we also store it within the file so that if you attach it to an email, send it to another place, store it on the server, that server would also recognize it. Okay, so we have the files marked as finance, so that's what we call manual classification. Let me show you automatic classification. So for automatic classification, I'll just go to my public shares I have some private information here that it's in text file, kind of like a very generic credit card information. If I'll go here to classification of the file, you will see that it has no classification. So especially, let's watch, the impact here is none. I'll just take the file and drag it here. Now what happens is that on this server, there's an automatic classification rule, looks at the content, and if it sees something that resembles credit card information, it's going to set the impact to high. So while we were talking, that happened. Okay. If we look at the classification again, you'll see now impact is high. I didn't need to do anything. The admin did one thing and that one time and put the rules in there. And now every file that comes in would be classified appropriately. Any questions on classification? Yes. The question was what happens when the classification changes or leaves the organization. So if it leaves the organization, as long as it's in the file, like if it's an office document, it will just remain in the file. If it's only in an alternate data stream, once you move it to, you know, you send it through email, it's gone. The other question, what happens if it changes? If it changes, if you go to, let's say you move it from the finance folder to the operations folder, it would remain finance. Until you change it manually and say, no, this is not finance, this is operations. We use the point of origin. And if you do automatic classification, the rules. So in the automatic classification rules, you can say override the existing value, merge with the existing value, and so on. Yes, please. I can't hear you, sorry. Great question. The permission required to set the classification is the same permission that's required to set the security of the file. So it's called forgot the name. But it so you know the control. I think it's a control permission. We can look it up. When we look at the classification. How did I forget this thing? It's when you look at the permissions. So it's not full control. You can do. I need to go to advanced. Let's remove this. But it's basically a write control. I need to go to advanced, yeah. Where is it? Yeah, I don't see it. But anyhow, it's called write control. So edit this guy. Okay, you guys are no, edit doesn't work. Edit. Okay, they hid it from me. Yeah. Okay, change permission. That's the one I was looking for. Okay, so if you can change permission, you can change the classification. Okay? Yeah. Sorry about that, guys. Yes. So the question was, sometimes the owner of the file, or actually, usually, it should be that the administrator does not have access to the file. So how can the automatic classification actually classify the file, correct? So it's very simple. The automatic classification is running a system. It can do whatever it wants. Okay, so we showed you automatic classification. Let me go back to the presentation. All right, so we automatically classify the file. Yay. Now, by the way, we can get reports of where all our sensitive data is. And we'll see that we can also get audit reports and access control based on this. But there's another very important thing we can do. We can actually now go ahead also and RMS encrypt the file. Anybody knows what RMS is? Okay, so for those who don't know, and RMS is what we call the Microsoft Rights Management, and it allows you to encrypt data, encrypt files, so that only specific users can open them to do specific operations on them. In this scenario that we're talking about, we're just talking about encryption of files so that either you have access to the file or you don't have access to the file. And the nice thing about RMS protection, RMS encryption, is that it is basically travels with the file. So the RMS team has done some great work to make sure this can be ubiquitous. How many of you have an RMS server deployed? I know only one there, yeah. So now you no longer need to deploy an RMS server to use RMS because there's an RMS service that allows you to use that. So you don't need to manage all this and so on. You can just use the RMS service. Now, some of you would say, oh, it's not secure, it's an RMS service. Yes, but the data is on-prem, so it doesn't go to the cloud. The RMS keys are in the cloud, so the guys from on-prem can't get to it. So if you have a rogue admin on-prem, he can do whatever he wants. If he doesn't have the keys, if he can't go and hack the cloud, he cannot get that keys. So you can actually use RMS protection from the cloud to protect your information on-prem. That is an extremely secure configuration for you. Because your admin on-prem cannot do anything. They can't get the keys, they're in the cloud. Okay, so think about it. You don't need to deploy anything, you just use RMS online. You use RMS online to encrypt data on the server. The content stays with you, the key stays with the cloud, everybody's happy. You don't need to go through hoops to manage RMS. And RMS also provided a way to encrypt any file, not only Office files. So now we're talking about any file that you want, that you find to be sensitive, you can actually RMS encrypt it. And if you want to open it on an iPad or Android, they allow you to do that. So you have no more excuses to not use RMS to encrypt your data so that your secure and administrators cannot get to it. So next time we meet next year, or in Tech at Europe, you know, when I ask about RMS, I want to see some hands. Okay, another thing that's pretty cool about this is that I am sure, as we are, you are, very, very concerned about the data on the desktops, on people's desktops. They're not on the servers, you can't get to them. So how many of you guys are aware of things like folder redirection, client-side caching, home folders, work folders? Okay, all this stuff helps you get the user's desktop data, that's corporate data, up to your server. Now it's on your server. You can scan it, you can encrypt it, and it will just go back to the user's desktop. So without the user needing to do anything, they got their file encrypted while they were working on their desktop. Now, I am a person that has that running on my desktop for 2 years now. I just work on my, you know, Windows vNext stuff. I save it. Next time I open it, it's already RMS encrypted. I can read it. I can do whatever I want with it. I can decrypt the stuff. If I really wanted to send it to someone who doesn't have access, I could. But I would need to do an operation that allows me to do that. So that I confirm that I did it. And the administrators on the server cannot get to my data. Just stuff to think about. These are all scenarios that are really, really easy to deploy. You don't need to go spend hundreds of thousands of dollars to deploy it. If you have a server 2012, you're there. Just saying. Let's see a demo. And again, this server has been running for 2 years. I've been showing this for a while. And I will now go to my client machine. on my client machine, I will open the public shares on my server. We have this customer information that I want you to see that it's not encrypted, but it has some sensitive data. I will wait for Word to close. And now as I copy the file here, what's going to happen? First of all, it's going to get classified. Oh, so it finds, you know, impact equals high. It found impact equals high. And I have another rule on my file server that says, oh, if impact equals high, go ahead and RMS encrypt it to the high impact template. Of course, the user just copied it. He's going to be the owner of the encryption. He can do whatever he wants. He can remove the encryption if he wants to, if it really bothers him. But if it doesn't bother him, and it shouldn't, he can just continue to work. So by the time I was talking, if I double-click on that file again, you will see that it's now RMS encrypted to an RMS template that's called iImpact Data. And I didn't need to do anything, okay? Any questions about RMS encryption? Yes. So I believe that Adobe, so the question is what file formats are supported for RMS? So of course Office, but, and we also have, we allow you to do any file format. There is a catch there, I'll tell you in a second. Adobe, I believe that Microsoft is working to, with either Adobe or another company to make sure that you can do that as well seamlessly. Now, for all other file formats, you'll see the file, let's say it's a text file. So you see the file with the same file name with a .ptxt extension, and it's going to be encrypted. When you open it, it's like a zip file. If you have the permission, it's going to open, and then you can open the .txt file, okay? So it's not as seamless as the Office. Yes?
I have a question regarding the Azure RMS. Uh-huh. Is that okay to ask now?
I can't hear you, I'm sorry.
Azure RMS?
Yes.
If I'm using Azure RMS and I have a document has a social security on it and I'm sending that out, so it's encrypted going out, right? In transit also encrypted. But how you find out that has sensitive data in it if you do not decrypting it? So how are you finding out the information if you're not decrypting it?
That's a great question. If the question was how can I find the information on it if it's already encrypted? So if it's already encrypted, of course the file server does not have access to it. So it's not going to be able to find the content within it. What I'm showing you is that if it's not yet encrypted, we're going to be able to classify it and then encrypt it. So if it's already encrypted, the method of classification that would work is not content-based classification. You can't look into the file. But still, if you put it in the right folder, it would still classify it. If you put it in the finance department, it would still classify it as department equals finance. So the encryption does not prevent classification. It just prevents content scanning. So other than content scanning, all other methods would still work. You can also right-click and classify it yourself if you wanted to. But you're absolutely right. It's a feature. We don't want it to happen that the file server will be able to open encrypted information. Because if the file server can do it, the administrator on the file server can do it. Okay? All right. So anybody notice anything weird, by the way, in this screen? Nobody yet. Okay. I just want to show you this screen on the... So remember, we're in the public shares. I'll just show you the public shares on the server side. This is the public share on the server side. Any difference you see? Sorry? Well, we have another file here, right? If we go, this private information TXT, if you go back to the client, you will not see it. Let me talk to you about why you can't see it. Okay. Before I talk to you about that, I need to talk to you about the data classification toolkit. So when we released file classification infrastructure in 2008 R2, it's been 6 years now, we said, oh, we're going to release it. Everybody knows how to classify their data. Everybody knows what tagging they want to use. The first year, we found the very, very painful truth that nobody knows how to classify their data. Nobody knows how to tag them, what tag they want to use. It's actually extremely hard to come up with a tagging scheme of what you want to do in your organization. You know, we worked with MSIT back then, 2009, and we worked with them. MSIT started from 200 different tags that they want to apply. And then we asked them, okay, what do you want to do with the tags once you apply them? And the result was that they needed only two tags, impact and retention. So we went ahead and just did the work to come up with a baseline that we think would satisfy 90% of the cases. And this is the baseline. If you want to add stuff, you can add stuff. If you want to remove stuff or not use stuff, you can do that as well. If you want to change, you can change. But we just give you, here's the baseline. When you install a Server 2012 domain controller, the baseline is there. And I'll show it to you in a second in the next demo. But you can decide to use it, or you can decide not to use it. It's your choice. But I can tell you this baseline is very good. All right, then, as I said, if you have thousands of servers, you can't just go to every server and configure it. So we built a tool called the Data Classification Toolkit that allows you to have some kind of a staging server, baseline server, that you configure. You run your all your classification on, all your RMS protection. You see everything is working. Everything is to your satisfaction. You export that configuration, and then you go and import it to your production file servers. And you can also compare whether they drifted or not. You can, you know, if you want to change something, you change on your baseline, export, import. It's very simple. Very simple concept. And then, after you classify your data, you can also collect reports to a central repository and get reports on into a SQL database and get reports of what, where your sensitive data is. So you can see, oh, where's my PII data across all my servers? It's not as fancy as other solutions that, you know, in the market, but these other solutions would cost you north of $500,000. Here you can be a hero with a few days of work. By the way, these other solutions, you would still need to spend these days of work and more. So comparatively, I didn't see a better solution up to now. And not because I own this. Okay, so another huge leap that we made in 2012, and we continue to use this as we move forward, is what we call expression-based access control. How many of you guys have more than 10,000 security groups? Okay. 100,000? I think in Microsoft we have around 1 million. Okay, so we know the pain. I'll explain why we think that we can solve it in 2012 and above. So there were two things we wanted to do. One is we wanted to really modernize access control without saying to you, oh, go configure all your access control. Because we know you cannot configure all your access control, you will break your organization. So that was one thing we wanted to do. The second thing we wanted to do is to allow you to control access based on who the user is, what the resource is, what the machine is, so that you can actually take it to the next level if you choose to do so in specific environments. Like in high-value environments, you can go and do very, very sophisticated stuff. Let me give you an example. So let's say you have 50 country, a folder structure, simple folder structure with 50 countries, you need 50 groups to protect that. You had another 1,000, you know, another 20 branches for each country, you get to 1,000 groups. Why do you get to 1,000 groups? Because in order to say that a specific, you know, to access specific countries and a specific branch within that country, you need one security group. You have to have the combination of all people that are specific to this branch and country in order to limit the access. And then, let's say you have 100 customers per branch, you easily get to 100,000 groups. So this is, of course, a fictitious example, but in our finance servers, we had 90,000 different ACEs. Think about managing this thing, right? Somebody's moving from finance India to finance China. How the hell are you going to change the user's access so that he can't access India anymore and he can only access China? It's very hard, I can tell you. We work with the finance guys, we got them to 3 ACLs from 90,000. The way you do that is you use expressions in your condition. So, for example, for accessing US, in example, US Seattle Contoso customer, instead of having a group specific to that, you can just say, if the user is in the US and is part of the Seattle branch and he has access to the Contoso customer, he can access. It's as simple as that. We introduced ends into the access control. That eliminates a tremendous amount of groups. You don't have to use it, but you can start using it whenever you want. Another example that's relevant for this, anybody's using smart cards or like, two-factor auth? Okay, so the way we implemented smart cards in Active Directory in Kerberos is that when you log in with a smart card, you get a group into your token. So say smart card group. So if I wanted to limit access to the US country to only folks that access with smart card, before 2012 I couldn't do it. I could either limit them to all the folks that access with smart card or to all the folks that has US access. But with 2012 I can say, oh, for this folder, only allow access if the user is in the US group and he logged in with the smart card. It's very, very simple. Now you can actually use smart cards and other two-factor auth technologies that use groups to really improve your access control. So if you have a folder on some file server that you want to make sure you protect to only folks that access with smart cards and are in a specific group, now you have a solution. Or you had that solution 3 years ago. Okay, so I really encourage you, if you're using smart cards, I really encourage you to look at that. Of course, we didn't stop there. We looked at it and said, okay, how do we modernize access control? So if you look at access control, it's all about the users that can access the data, the devices that they're using, and what data they're going to access. So with users, you can use user groups, or you can use user claims with 2012 and above. You can now also add devices into the fray. So you can have what we call compound identity, where you have the user token carries both the user context and the device context that he's using. So now you can authorize based on both. There's things like we want to make sure that a workstation that's going to connect to a very high value server is an authorized workstation. So we want to be able to use device claims for that to make sure that both the user context and the device context are the same. And last, we are able to tag the resources. So now we can actually apply access control based on this as well. So you could do things like allow access only if user department equals file department. I just saved you another 1,000 groups. And device is managed, right? So this is an example for that. The thing is that I didn't say where the file is in this picture. It's all about what the file is and not where it is. So I can apply this policy across all my servers in a consistent way. That's what we call central access policy. So if you think about expression-based access control, you can use it in your ACL today. And actually, I didn't show it, but I'll show it as I go back to the security. I'll show you in the advance how you can do that. And you can also use it centrally across all your servers or the servers that you choose to protect. There's a few things that people asked over the years about central access policies and DAC and expression-based access control. So expression-based access control, if you use it on the server needs to be 2012. But the client can be any client. Doesn't need to be Windows 8. You can use an iPad, you can use an Android, you can use a Surface if you have it, you can use anything you want, Windows XP. Do you need to upgrade all your DCs? You don't need to upgrade all your DCs. If you're just using, you know, expression-based access control with groups, you don't need any upgrade. If you're using user claims, you need one DC in your user environment to be able to do that. When do you use claims? When do you use groups? First of all, you don't have claims, so start using groups. Okay. Now, as you want to introduce claims into your system, there is things that you need to think about. There need to be as secure as groups. So if I can change my claims, I can change my access. You don't want that, right? When you introduce a claim, it needs to be secure. It needs to come from a secure location. So let's say user.department is the worst claim you can use because departments keeps changing all the time. And we in Microsoft use the employee type. So employee type is a very secure attribute for Microsoft that comes from the HR database. So that's a good claim to use. The second thing about a claim, it needs to change very rarely. Because think about if you change your department name from finance to the great finance, right? Immediately everybody loses access. Because you're not going to go and change your files, all your files to be great finance. So things to think about claims. Rarely changed, values rarely change, need to be secure. Requirements for device claims. If you want to get the device claim into the fray, you need to use the Windows 8 and above, and you need to upgrade your DCs. No escape from that one. The reason for that is that for the user claims, the server, it doesn't matter how the user authenticated, the server can just go and say and ask the DC, what's the claim for these users? For the device, the server has no clue which device the user is using, so it has to happen on the device. That's why the device needs to be Windows 8, and the domain controller, the initial action to the domain controller needs to be to a certified domain controller, which is 2012 and above. So if you want to use device claims, you need to upgrade the client. Now, you can have, let's say you have 10 devices of Windows 8, and 100,000 devices of Windows 7, that's still okay. You can still use device claims, and only these devices will get access to resources that require device claims, which is fine. If you have a high-value workstation that you would like to use an administrator to access your high-value assets, you can have only that workstation be Windows 8 and all others not be Windows 8. All others will just not be able to access the I value assets, which is what you want. So that's absolutely fine. Do you need to worry about Kerberos token size? Well, experience shows that you don't. So we can go into a very deep discussion, but we did a lot of things to make sure that you don't need to do that. And it did prove that you don't. Performance, you're not going to notice any performance. Again, we didn't see anybody hit any performance issue. We didn't worry about it from the beginning, but I can tell you now we didn't. ADFS story. Anybody knows what ADFS is? Okay, cool. So very shortly, the ADFS story is that we have a one-way gateway. So if you use Kerberos on-prem and then use ADFS to federate to the cloud, for example, ADFS is going to carry the claims, user claims and device claims, in the auth token. Or in the SAML token. So that way is on. If you use ADFS to authenticate, then the file server doesn't know it, and it doesn't matter. You can't access the file server using ADFS. You need to use Kerberos. So the path from Kerberos up to ADFS carries the claims up with that path. Okay? All right. Another demo. So, let's go to my Active Directory. So in this Active Directory, you can see where all my resource properties were defined, and you can see that I have all of them by default, but I only enabled a few, like country, department, impact. So these guys, you can see they're operational versus the other ones that are not. So basically, I had all of them already defined. I just enabled the ones that I wanted to use. Now, in Active Directory, I also have something called central access rules. So this is where, you remember I talked about a policy that I can apply across all my servers? This is where I define it. I define it in Active Directory. So here's a central access rule for you. I have a departmental rule that basically says, oops, let me just get that. Basically says, allow access only if user.department equals resource.department. I have another rule here that says, okay, I don't want to close the server. For information that is high impact, allow access only to the owner, administrators, or full or system. So these are the only three that can access it. Basically, if there is a department on the file, allow access only to users that are from the same department. And for files that are high impact, allow access only to the owner of the file. Just an example. And then, if I go to the file server, back to my file server, you can see that on the file server, I can go to the department shares and go to the security, advanced, and I can apply a central access policy that is defined in AD, and this central access policy contains these two rules that I just showed you. Okay, so I can apply that. So basically, I applied that central access policy that says, if the user department matches, allow access. If it doesn't, don't allow access. And the same for high impact, allow access only to owners. So I did that. Let's go now to my client. So on my client machine, let's see who this guy is. So I'm going to say, who am I? And ask for the claims. And you can see that this guy, Tim, is from the operations department. Okay, so he should have access to the operation files. Let's see if that works. So if I go to the department's operations, he can see the files, he can work on them, he has full access, no problem. But if he tries to see, you know, his manager's salary in the finance department, he cannot, because he was told by the central access policy that says you have to be from the same department. And by the way, he's not getting that, you know, call your local administrator message. He's getting the, oh, you know, this is why you couldn't. No, for troubleshooting, you can do a bunch of things like go to a portal, or you can also request assistance, and that sends an email to the right owner of the share or of the of whatever the file server wants to send the email to, whatever it's configured to send the email to. Okay, on the other side, so Tim could not get access. Let's go to the file server. How many of you have ever tried to troubleshoot access problems? Okay, so you'll sympathize with me when I tell you about my favorite features in the release. We're on the file server. Let's go to the finance share. And if I go and right-click properties to security again and advanced, everything we put there. Oh, I'm not, sorry, I'm on the client. I don't have access to that. That's the right thing. Let's go to the server. So if I go to the finance, so I got that email from Tim. He said, I don't have access. I go to the finance, I go to security, advanced, and I go to effective access. I can go and say, okay, what's up with Tim? And this shows me now that Tim does not have access, surprisingly. But it also shows me What limits the access? Is it the share? Is it the file ACL? Is it the central access policy? And it shows me here, you know, TIM doesn't have access because of the department access rule. And I can go in, of course, to central policy and see, oh, department access rule, TIM needs to be in the same department. Okay, let me go back here and say, what if TIM was from department finance? And I can see that now we would actually get access. Now, this is, of course, a trivial example. But if you have 50 groups that you need to figure out where TIM, where you should add TIM in order to have access, right? That's a problem. Like, if you added TIM to the wrong group, it takes like 2 days to figure out that he didn't have access. The guy is, you know, pulling his hairs because he needs to do his work. He can't get to the files. Somebody's sending them through email. The whole security model is just gone, right? So here you're able to actually see very quickly, oh, this is what I need to do to provide TIM with minimal access to what he needs to do, and then you can go ahead and do that. Just to show you that, you know, we didn't just build the technology and said, okay, you guys go figure it out. We really thought about how we can help you end-to-end on this. And just to show you the expression, so I'm on the file server, and I'm going to add another ACL. This is not a central access policy. It's just an ACL on the file. So we'll say the principle is everyone. And here I can say, you know, I have conditions. So I can say user group, member of, let me just do user, not group, but a company equals Contoso. And user group, member of whatever, administrators. And you get the, like, you can do ands, ors, and so on. So the expression is actually built into the ACL. Even if you don't use central access policies, you can still use expression-based access control on your current ACLs in your file server or in anywhere in Windows. This is basically Windows baseline. We didn't change the file system. We changed Windows below the file system. Okay? Question? Yeah? That's a great question. You don't need to be logged into the file server in order to have permission. In order to see it, you need to have permission, of course. And there's also an API that you can use to actually, if you want to view a lot of effective permissions, you can use an API to do that as well. Okay? The question was whether you need to be logged into the file server to see the permissions, to see effective permissions. Yes? Great question. What if the question was, what if it's not a Windows Server 2012? It's something else. So our partner at NetApp actually developed the same dynamic access control capabilities so that you can use it with NetApp as well. I think they're going to announce beta pretty soon. And, you know, feel free to come by. I think I have the contact with me that I can point you to. And if not, I'll just send you my email, and I'll connect you. Okay? But I work with the guys there to make sure they can implement DAC on NetApp, and you know we'll work with anyone that wants to work with us, any NAS device wants to work with us to help them implement the same access policy because we believe this is really really important to enable you to secure your organization. Absolutely, yes. It's implemented on the operating system of the storage. Yeah. You're right. The question was whether the capability is storage dependent. Yes. Yes. Yeah. Yeah, the comment was that if you buy the array and you use it as a nice SCSI target and the Windows server as the front end, then you would get that capability as well, of course. So it's a SAN configuration. Yes, thank you. All right, so anybody can guess why? You remember that reader before, why you couldn't see the files? I'll go back to my... I should have given some prizes. Then I know people will participate. So we see four files here. And if I go to my client, make sure that I count them correctly. I'll go to the public shares. I see only three files. Any guesses from people? Sorry? Yeah, so right, we're using access-based enumeration here. So access-based enumeration means if you don't have access to the file, you can't see it. Now, why can't you see this file? Because we classify it as high business impact. And the central access policy kicks in and says, oh, high business impact, only the owner can actually access it. So think about like a banking environment where somebody puts something, like somebody just does something stupid and puts something on a public share, right? People will not be able even to see that it's there because it's classified as high business impact or as something else that they shouldn't see. And then the file server can also send you an email saying, oh, you have something bad here, you might want to take a look at it. Any other questions? Oh, sharks. Let's go back here. So I'm going to quickly go through this. This is, and then I'll give Stan some time because I'm running out of time. So one example of a great solution for using a central access policy is, again, it's the simple examples that are really great. So the idea is that you have a user forest and a resource forest here, and you would like to be able to have users only access files that are relevant for the community of interest. It's as simple as that. So if you tag the files with the right community of interest, then you can have something that says a user can only access a file that is from the same community of interest as him. So you have a user attribute, and you tag the files appropriately, you can have a million different community of interests that's managed by some system. As long as it provides the right, as long as it sets the right user attribute, you have one rule to control all this access in a very, very secure way that even the administrator will need to go and jump through hoops to be able to get access to. And it's the simple solutions that really make it shine. And of course, if the file is not tagged, no one can access it. So until the file was tagged, no one can access it other than the owner. And once the file is tagged, then only folks from the same community of interest can access it. It's simple, it's elegant, and it just does its work. And the idea is that you're able to translate your business requirements to a security policy in that way. All right, Stan. Any questions, by the way? Okay. Okay. So let Stan do his piece, and then we'll stay around as much as you want.
Okay. Can everyone hear me? Yes. Great. Okay. My name is Stan Sims. I work in the Information Security Risk Management Group at Microsoft, in the safety team specifically. My role is to evaluate security-related technologies for Windows Server, and then help deploy those across Microsoft. And a recent deployment we finished was the File Classification Infrastructure, FCI. So just quickly, how many of you out there have deployed or used FCI? Okay, well, hopefully that number is going to increase after my presentation, but we'll see. First, I'd like to... tell you a little bit about the environment we deployed in. The DataBox environment at Microsoft houses the file history and IntelliMirror services. And that boils down to really just employee files on their desktops that they use and create for work. And this environment was about 86 file servers worldwide, just over half a petabyte of data, and growing at 15% per year. And we knew just the because of the nature of the files, that there had to be a good amount of high business impact and personally identifiable information in this data. And I'm going to call it HBI and PII from here on. And so that was a big risk, because those files were at risk for leakage and for loss of control if people emailed them out or whatever. Those files needed to be protected. And we had no way at the time to actually discover, classify, and protect those data files, nor be able to have any automated processes around them. So the only thing we did have was a 30-party solution that did some regulatory scanning, and all it would do is look at some files and it would encrypt them directly. So we had three requirements. We needed to be able to discover and classify HBI and PII. We needed to be able to protect those files by encrypting them and applying RMS protection and prevent anyone from accessing them that didn't have a valid Microsoft login credential. And then finally, we needed to be able to notify the owners of those files what we were doing and why we were doing it, and what the applicable policies were at Microsoft for handling and storage of HBI. And so that was basically the scope of the deployment. And I'd like to talk to you now about how we went about that. We started with what we call a baseline configuration. And this is where you build out a test server, you build your configuration in that test server, you test it until you know it's perfect enough to go to production, and then it becomes, as Nir kind of alluded to in his data classification toolkit portion, it becomes a central point of deployment. You deploy out from that central configuration, and it really gives you two things. One is, because you're only making changes to one place for any changes that are needed, it's very efficient. And not only that, pushing those files out to the file servers is very efficient, because DCT, that's the acronym for Data Classification Toolkit, is very quick and easy to use. It's a wizard, and it's a few steps in the wizard, and bang, the deployment server has the configuration. It's also very reliable, because you're not going out to all those servers and making changes in all of them, which would result in inconsistencies and mistakes and that sort of thing. You're only making changes to that central piece. So I'm going to go a little faster now because we're really running out of time, but the bottom line is that we built this configuration. It consisted of the rules that we developed by looking at studying what our high business impact information looked like. You gather those files, you look at them, you see the kinds of footers and headers and descriptors and tags and things that people use to indicate the sensitivity of those documents. And then you build regular expressions to find those things. And then we added some social security number rules, credit card rules, HR rules, et cetera. And to that, we attached the scope of what we wanted to scan. So we looked at what FCI could do out of the box, and we decided on going with Microsoft Office documents and PDFs. But to do the PDFs, we had to download an iFilter, and that extends the capability of FCI or any other application to be able to read that format. And so we downloaded Adobe's PDF iFilter, and we put those scopes into our rules so that the rules knew what they're going to be applied against. And then we had to indicate how we were going to classify the data. So we went and created, as you saw in that presentation, there's resource properties. We created one called ImpactMS and gave it three values, low, medium, and high. And so these rules, when triggering, will set that value to high. And that's how we know it's high business impact. And then finally, we created a file task in FCI. It's very simple to do. And in there, you just tell it the property you want to look at and what to do when that property is a certain value. And in this case, we're looking at that property. If it's high, we're going to apply ADRMS to it and with the Microsoft All Rights template, which means you have to have valid login credentials from Microsoft to read it. Also, we turned on the audit logging feature in the file task, and what that does is it shows you, for every single classification event that occurs, which of your rules triggered on that file. That's very critical for understanding the effectiveness of your rules. It lets you debug them, basically. And then we turned on error logging, which allows you to determine where you're unable to read certain formats. And that was really important because we figured out that the Adobe's iFilter wasn't working. We couldn't read PDFs. I guess you get what you pay for. So we downloaded Foxit's iFilter and tested their evaluation copy, and it worked excellent. But we didn't use it because it wasn't in our budget. So just beyond that, then the basic configuration also included a storage report by file property. And this gives you a visual representation and a breakdown of all your classifications, your file types, the owners, and how that all breaks down. And it gives you a great way to see how your file scanning is working. And so with all of that, we built a capability to collect all the audit reports to a single location, have an Excel pivot file that we could look at the top 10 detections, for instance, and see who has the most HBI. And that was the approach we took. So now I'd like to talk to you about the results of the deployment. So in the end, we had protected over 85 terabytes of employee files across those 23 servers that we deployed to. That was over 80 million files and 26,000 users involved in that. And the detection rates were actually quite small, 1% for HBI and 0.32 for PII, PII being the social security numbers and the credit card numbers, that sort of thing. But the real great story here was the performance. It was outstanding. We were able to achieve 36 megabytes per second scanning rate. That's scanning, classifying, encrypting, and applying a rights management. That other solution I told you about, it doesn't even do classification, and it was 40 times slower, so not much of a competition. But anyway, we're scanning over 2,000 files per minute, which is just outstanding. All right. Now the insights from our deployment. One thing we learned, and it was kind of a big duh, was that we didn't really need to notify users every time we classified their files. I mean, all we really needed to do was post a notification at the sign up for the services or send the users who use those services one email describing what we're doing. So we turned that off. You can imagine with 26,000 users, that was a lot of churn when people were going, huh, what's this? How come you're doing that? So yeah, don't do that unless you really have to. Another thing is we want to look at using RMS online. I said in the beginning our file scope was really Microsoft Office documents, and that's because ADRMS can't really protect anything else, but RMS Online can. It can support any format. So they just recently added the capability to connect that to your file servers. So that's great. Another thing is, as time goes on, people are going to have new keywords, new ways of identifying their critical information. There'll be different phrases used, that sort of thing. So we need to keep on top of how we evolve our rules to close those detection gaps. Another thing is we want to make sure we rid ourselves of misclassifications, calling something a high business impact file that's really not. So that's something we'll do as we go. And then maybe there's a business case there to invest in Foxit's iFilter. We'll be looking at that as well. And then as your audit file logs grow over time and get into the millions of rows, it really passes the point where you can use something like Excel to do your analysis. You need to look at other tools. And so we've looked at some third-party tools that are just awesome, and it's really helped us to analyze our results. And so, you know, I mentioned we had this top 10 report. Well, the cool thing about it was we looked at who those top 10 people were, and you can see there on the slide, U.S. payroll director, director of compensation. You know, all these people, yes, they have access to the most sensitive information at the company, so we know we're hitting the right spots. And when I said the performance was good for scanning, it was outstanding because even at scale, scanning multiple terabytes of data on each server, users had no degradation in their service for file history or IntelliMirror. They didn't know what was happening. It was all transparent to them. And speaking of long-running jobs, what we're going to do, or what we've done actually, is we're moving to continuous classification. That's a new feature they just added where it's always on. You don't run a job. And so anytime a file gets copied, moved to, or changed on the file server, boom, it's classified. You saw that in his demo. And that lets you not have to worry about long-running jobs getting interrupted for maintenance or anything else like that. So I highly recommend using that. That's all I had to talk about. I'm sorry I had to go through so fast, but we've got some resources here you can look into if you want to look up RMS online, for instance. Thank you for listening. Thank you for coming.
Any question, guys? Yes, please. Go ahead. In terms of, I'm sorry, what? With the fast, that's a great question. The question was whether we're going to integrate the file classification with the fast engine. There are several answers to that. One answer that I can tell you today is that if you you can include the classification of the files in the fast engine, so it should be able to see them and show you these properties. That's one that should be available today, at least in SharePoint. SharePoint can scan file servers and show you the classification properties. Yes?
How do you deal with backups?
How do we deal with what? With backups? So the question was, how do we deal with a restore of an encrypted file? So the question was, how do we deal with the restore of encrypted files? The if you use RMS, the key scheme should persist for forever. Like that's, you shouldn't lose the keys, even if they recycle them. If they recycle the keys, they usually keep the old keys, and they use the new key to encrypt the new content.
Before you forget, please remember to fill out your evaluations. Thank you.
Well, it depends if they're good or bad.
Well.
No. No. Yes, please.
Oh, that's a great question. Thank you. The question was, what account do we use to scan those files, those PII files? Because obviously there's privacy involved with that, right? The answer is FCI runs under a system account. So it scans those files as system. It's not a person who has access to those files. The system itself scans its own drives.
It's local, so the question is, how do you get through NAS files? It's all local on the server. The server itself is doing that scan.
Yes. Yeah, it's all local.
Any other questions? Okay, thank you very much, guys,
thank
for coming
you.
And enjoy the rest of the day.